Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. On Capitol Hill yesterday, lawmakers called on Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt to resign. He testified about ethics violations and excessive spending. He's facing more than six investigations over lavish trips, questionable staff pay raises to friends and allies, getting a sweetheart deal, a very cheap deal, on an apartment in Washington, D.C., owned by an energy lobbyist, and more. The EPA is a massive institution that affects so many aspects of our lives. This week, Scott Pruitt announced a new policy that would restrict the kinds of scientific studies the agency can use in developing its regulations. Today's guest, Rebecca Lieber, reports that this might be Scott Pruitt's most destructive move yet. Joseph Goffman, a former EPA, told her, quote, "He's changing the internal rules of the game by which the EPA plays in order to rig it," end quote. Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. Also this month, the Senate voted to confirm former Andrew Wheeler as the number two official at the EPA, right behind Scott Pruitt. Andrew Wheeler is a former coal lobbyist for Murray Energy. Prior to his work as a lobbyist, he was a top aide to one of Congress's most prominent climate science deniers, Senator James Inhofe, a Republican of Oklahoma. Marianne Lavelle has been writing about this. She's an award-winning reporter covering the environment, science, law, and business for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization focusing on climate change, energy, and the environment. Hi, Marianne. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Marianne Lavelle, let's start off with you. What grabbed your attention this week?
Well, what grabbed my attention was a book that came out this week called War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence by Ronan Farrow. And this, I have to admit that I have not yet read the book or read anything that didn't have to do with Scott Pruitt this week. But an excerpt of the book appeared in The New Yorker about the last days of Rex Tillerson. Mm-hmm. And Ronan Farrow, we all know, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who wrote about Harvey Weinstein. But he also used to work at the State Department, and he really brings this kind of insider's sensibility to writing about this just monumental change and retreat from diplomacy that we're seeing right now at the State Department. His piece in The New Yorker kind of starts with this scene of Tillerson's aides bickering over which one of them will accompany Ronan Farrow into the interview with Tillerson. But as the piece unfolds, you see that this is just emblematic of the deeper dysfunction that has taken place at the State Department. And he interviews all the former living secretaries of state, and I think Colin Powell it memorably says the Trump administration is ripping the guts out of the State Department and mortgaging the future. And it really is an important issue, and it seems really well reported.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the Senate just confirmed CIA Chief Mike Pompeo to be the new Secretary of State. And Marianne, because things move so quickly, the Rex Tillerson running the State Department seems like it was so long ago. Is there anything else in that piece that really struck you that maybe didn't get the attention it deserved when we learned that Rex Tillerson was leaving?
I think the thing that really comes across is the feeling that it's not that important to have a team. There's so many vacancies, and I know this has been written about, but it just is going to have such a lasting impact. And I think it may have been Colin Powell or John Kerry who said this. It takes a long time to build the expertise, and it so can so quickly be eliminated. And of course, writing about climate change as I do, the retreat from leadership of America's historic role as leader on climate change diplomacy is just it's just really an important thing that's happening under the Trump administration.
Mm. Well, we will definitely link to that piece in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow. His new book is War on Peace. And that is Marianne Lavelle, an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News. And what about you, Rebecca Lieber? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Oh, well, I've been pretty caught up with Pruitt coverage. But I think and on that note, actually, I thought there was a great story in The New Republic by Emily Atkin about the how the EPA is borrowing tactics from Big Tobacco in some of its latest announcements on science. And I think it's a good step back to look at what the EPA is doing is not particularly new.
All right, and we'll link to that piece in the New Republic at yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive right in and talk about the Scott Pruitt testimony yesterday. Rebecca, you were there yesterday, and in the broadcast media, you know how they love drama. What are the Republicans saying? What are the Democrats saying? And there have been really great reports about the excessive spending, lavish trips, questionable staff pay raises to friends and allies, that sweetheart deal on an apartment in D.C., which is owned by an energy lobbyist. What would you say we need to know at this point about these ethics violations and why he was called to testify?
Well, Pruitt is facing at least 9 investigations from the EPA Inspector General over his ethical behavior. A lot of news that you just recapped has emerged just the last few weeks about the types of people he's hired, his close connections to lobbyists, and some of the deals that benefited him financially. Yesterday was a major chance for lawmakers to question him and get some more clarity about these actions. And Pruitt was ostensibly on the Hill to testify about the EPA's budget, but obviously there was a lot else to talk about. So lawmakers focused on his actions at the EPA and the ethical scandals. But you did see a disconnect between how Republicans and Democrats treated Pruitt in the hearing, with Republicans still largely defending his behavior and talking about what they've liked about his policy at the EPA, while Democrats really dug in on the scandals.
And Marianne, the scandals, we know about these scandals because there's been such good reporting over the last couple months on the EPA and what's happening behind the scenes. What has really struck you about the reporting that has come out in the past few months?
What it shows is, for Scott Pruitt, for one reason or another, seems to have a blind spot over why a public official might want to keep an arm's length relationship with lobbyists. And this really has a connection to what's actually happening at the EPA. He sees lobbyists as just another constituent. The industry lobbyist is just another constituent, and doesn't really seem to be seeing his role as kind of an advocate of the public in these issues that he is he is having to decide. And so when you read about, of course, the excessive travel, the deal, which is incredible, on a place to live in D.C., and even the New York Times, speaking of good reporting, their story over the weekend on the fancy home he bought from a lobbyist back in Oklahoma City. To me, I think what you have to come back at is what does it mean about what's happening with environment and public health protection in the U.S. And really, this should be what his focus is. And the questions about his relationships with lobbyists, I think that to me is the most problematic thing. It's coming at a time where we're seeing this incredible rolling back of these protections.
Right. And can you also talk about that, Rebecca? Because people like to talk about the $43,000 soundproof phone booth, which, of course, that's very important. But what about going deeper, as Marianne just said, to talk about the relationship with lobbyists, what's happening with the EPA in terms of regulation rollbacks? I mean, what we're really seeing at the APA, what are your thoughts about what came out yesterday? Was it more than just the $43,000 phone book, the excessive spending, the apartment? That's very important, but did the other things also come out?
There was, I think, less focus on substantive policy debate and the hearing that tends to be how Washington works when you have these dramatic moments and hearings. There's less substantive conversation, but I think there was at least one really interesting and revealing exchange where Congresswoman questioned Pruitt about his views on climate change. And this didn't get that much attention given the stories like the phone booth, but Pruitt was asked about the EPA having authority to regulate on carbon emissions and his rollback of the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. And Pruitt's answer was a modification of what he's usually said, which is he doesn't think Congress gave the EPA authority to regulate on climate change, or at least not authority for the Clean Power Plan, which is not true, because if you look back at a Supreme Court decision, Massachusetts versus EPA, that compelled the EPA to make a decision about greenhouse gases being harmful for human health, if that's what the science says, which it does. So I think issues like this really weren't the top tier of the conversation yesterday, but they were revealing about his views, as Marianne said, where Pruitt is listening much more closely to what lobbyists have to say than what the science does.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment, science, and law for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit that focuses on climate change and the environment. And it's our media roundtable today on Your Call. We are talking about media coverage of Scott Pruitt's testimony yesterday on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers, Democrats, are calling on him to resign. As Rebecca said, he is facing at least 9 investigations. And Rebecca, interestingly, in the New York Times, the Scott Pruitt story was on page A16. You were at the hearing yesterday. What did you think of the questions reporters were asking politicians about Scott Pruitt?
Well, there's usually a scrum of reporters after the hearing, and House Representative, who was the subcommittee chair of the hearing, Shimkus, was asked about what he thought of Pruitt's answers, and he answered that they were pretty vague, but it's ultimately out of his control what happens to Pruitt. And if you're asking how the media has been covering Pruitt, I think I just commend the work that, and all of the revelations that have come out the last few weeks is due to a lot of hard work and digging that predates just a few weeks. It's been going on for years. And I think reporters, as far as asking Pruitt questions, they have not had an opportunity to do that. I think it's worth noting that earlier this week, the EPA had an event at its headquarters to roll out a major science announcement And the event was closed to the press. And instead, Pruitt was surrounded by his conservative allies and advocates of this announcement. So
Rebecca, it was an event about transparency.
The event was about, in Pruitt's words, about science transparency. It's not exactly what was going on, but they kept the details private until just before the event happened. There was a live stream, but no opportunity to ask Pruitt any questions.
Is this unusual? What has the relationship been like between the media and past heads of EPA, Rebecca?
Well, there's always been some friction, and looking at, for example, the Society of Environmental Journalists, which is a group that advocates for journalists who and their access to agencies and government like the EPA. In the Obama administration, there was a letter from SCJ saying that reporters were limited in access and complaining of a few things that the EPA had done to limit opportunities for questions from reporters. But the frame here of mine has really shifted, where a lot of these more minor complaints from the Obama era have just become parodies of itself, where reporters are inexplicably removed from agency press lists. They are getting personally attacked by the EPA press office in email blasts or to other outlets. And there was a contract, for example, the EPA hired out a Republican opposition research firm in December to help with media monitoring, and that was a story that I broke along with my colleagues, and that contract was canceled in the end. But I think it really tells you what kind of environment reporters are operating in here. And I do think it, when you talk to especially the longtime EPA reporters, this is a much more extreme version of limiting access than we've seen.
Marianne, what has your experience been like?
Yeah, what I'd like to add, and that report by Rebecca and her colleagues was really, really revelatory about the Pruitt Trump administration feel about their dealings with the media. I think it's very telling how Administrator Pruitt, when he first floated the idea of this policy announced this week on limiting the kinds of science that EPA uses, which will have enormous impact on health and safety regulation. He first floated this idea in an interview with the Daily Caller, which is a conservative publication website run by Tucker Carlson. And when you called the EPA to find out any details about this, they just referred you to the Daily Caller website. And, I had never experienced anything like that before, and I believe that the National Association of Science Writers actually wrote a letter of protest about the way the agency was handling that. Even earlier this week, Administrator Pruitt had an event in Georgia where he did not, he was planting a tree and talking about the carbon neutrality of tree burning in Georgia. Again, never announced it to the press, never told any the media what's going on. Well, that decision is a very important decision on that really could undercut other types of renewable energy. It could cause even more carbon pollution if handled wrong, and it cuts off the work that was being done by the Science Advisory Board on this carbon neutrality issue. We wrote this week that some of the lobbyists who were working on this issue were some of Administrator Pruitt's old friends from Oklahoma. And this, again, he does not have an arm's length relationship with lobbyists, and it really then raises more questions about how decision-making is being made.
We're going to go to break in about 3 minutes. Before we do that, Marianne, can you tell us about Andrew Wheeler, who was just confirmed by the Senate to become the number two official at the EPA behind Scott Pruitt?
Right, right. He is a former the former chief lobbyist for Murray Energy, which is really the largest underground coal company in the U.S., but all, more than that, Robert Murray has been one of the earliest and most avid supporters of Donald Trump, and really has a kind of an outsized influence with the administration compared to really where the coal industry is in the economy. And so Andrew Wheeler also used to work for James Inhofe for many years. He is somebody, unlike a lot of people who've been appointed, he has government experience. He used to work at the EPA. Of course, he spent all of those years on the Hill. I imagine that if the day came when Scott Pruitt resigned or had to step down, Andrew Wheeler would pick up the same sort of policies that Mr. Pruitt is taking, which makes me wonder if he, even though Pruitt seems to have had a lot of support from Republicans, wouldn't they be just as happy with Andrew Wheeler in charge there? Eventually, he would have to be go through a confirmation process, but I think we would see him carry on the same sorts of rollback on regulations that Mr. Pruitt is carrying out.
Andrew Wheeler has said, quote, "I believe that man has an impact on the climate, but it's not completely understood what that impact is." Rebecca, can you give us any insights? What does that mean exactly? Any idea? And what else do we need to know about Andrew Wheeler?
Well, Wheeler comes from this skeptic world. He worked for Senator Inhofe for years, who's the probably Congress's biggest climate change denier, who actively calls it a hoax. And he has lobbied on behalf of the coal company as Murray Energy, as Marianne pointed out. And so he is coming from this world that that says the science doesn't show climate change is happening or human-caused or a threat. And that's what he's echoing with his remarks when he says that diminishing what science tells us about climate change. And I think Marianne really hit on these points well, that Pruitt and Wheeler, there isn't that much daylight, it seems, between them on the policy front. Wheeler has worked for people who are openly questioning the EPA's endangerment finding that is basically the basis for all of its climate regulation. And that's a major area that the right-wing skeptics are still pushing for the EPA to undertake a formal reversal of this endangerment finding. So in terms of policy, if Wheeler were to take over the EPA, you probably wouldn't see a major change in the pace of what the deregulation that we've seen and other policies. But some people have suggested to me in my reporting that Wheeler perhaps might know better how to navigate these ethical issues just because he has come from this world of working inside Congress for years and working as a lobbyist. But of course, we have to see what happens there. But that was one area that was suggested where Wheeler might depart from Pruitt.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. And Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News. Coming up after a break, we will talk about some of the deregulatory actions we are seeing by this administration and the EPA. And I'll ask Rebecca and Marianne to talk about the shifts that they're seeing in environmental reporting. This is Your Calls Weekly Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's discussion, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the weekly news with 1A, Joshua Johnson from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Call's Weekly Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And today we are joined by Rebecca Lieber, reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment, science, law, and business for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization focusing on climate change and the environment. And we're talking today about EPA head Scott Pruitt testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday about ethics violations and excessive spending. Democrats have called him to resign. We have an email from Tim who says, I'm concerned that we're normalizing the blustery, rude, never mind the facts response from the Trump people who are called for illegal and unethical behavior. Fake news is now the go-to line when they're caught stealing. I really hope the EPA, the DOJ, and other institutions can withstand the full-on assault for the benefit of the kleptocracy. Democracy is not guaranteed. Appreciate you for helping us stay informed. Well, to that point, Rebecca, The Nation's George Zornick had a piece called Senate Democrats Demand Answers About the Koch Grip on Trump. And he was writing about Scott Pruitt's very close connections to the Koch brothers, as well as White House Legislative Director Mark Short, who the Washington Post reported is one of the few in the administration willing to defend Scott Pruitt. And Mark Short has also very close connections to the Koch brothers. Can you talk about these connections? And have you seen these connections being reported in places like, let's say, the PBS NewsHour, New York Times, Washington Post?
Well, I think the Trump administration's connections to the fossil fuel industry is a worthy story, and I do think a lot has emerged about just how close these two entities are, or it's almost impossible to distinguish sometimes. And a few examples of that I'm afraid aren't necessarily the Koch brothers, but I think our powerful influences in the Trump White House include Bob Murray, who is a coal magnate who bragged to, I believe it was PBS actually, about giving Trump and Pruitt a document laying out his policy wishes in his administration, and telling this outlet that he's been happy to see the entire first page checked off. And there are other voices like Harold Hamm, who comes from Oklahoma, an oil and gas billionaire, who also has influence in the Trump administration and happens to be very close with Scott Pruitt, having led his reelection campaign for attorney general. And I think you do see very strong connections between the Trump White House and the people he picked, and the fossil fuel industry, and in many cases, the ideas for who to pick these nominations were also probably floated in these worlds to Trump. I do think I think there has been a lot of reporting on this issue. There was an incredible New York Times series a few years ago that really exposed the close ties between Scott Pruitt and Devon Energy, and I think a follow-up reporting as well on his ties to other to the world of the Kochs and other oil and gas and coal entities. I mean, there's probably a lot more than has been uncovered so far. But I do think people are working on it, including me and Inside Climate News.
Marianne, what would you add? The Nation is also reporting that Samantha Davis, Associate Administrator of the EPA's Office of Policy, was former president of the Rule of Law Defense Fund, which was funded in part by the Koch brothers. Daisy Letendra, a senior EPA advisor on policy, worked at the Koch brothers' Millennial Outreach Group. I mean, there are at least five examples in this article.
Yes, I think we even had more in an article earlier this winter. There's a ton of kind of embeds of the Koch brothers network throughout the administration, and especially on environmental issues. And it's striking because the line of the Koch brothers during the campaign was the choice between Trump and Clinton was like between cancer and a heart attack, something like that, that they didn't like either of the candidates. But when you look at what happened in the end, they really they have won enormous influence, coming into a vacuum of sorts, because really I think, and there's been a lot of writing on this as well, President Trump himself is not so much ideological about this, but the Koch brothers are ideological about it. And where Trump himself did not have a large stable of experts with government experience to draw on to put in these positions, the Koch brothers really did have, they had a huge number of people who in their incredible network of nonprofits who have been working on these issues for years, and now they are throughout the whole administration. Samantha Davis apparently no longer. She has resigned under, you know, somewhat still not fully explained circumstances, because the Democrats sent a letter to Pruitt saying they didn't think she was showing up for work. Pruitt, I think that was one of the many things he said he is not aware of. I think there has been a lot of reporting on this. The reason I believe that you may feel like it's not having any impact is that the Republican majority in Congress has really just decided to back the administration, and it's somewhat striking, as Rebecca really detailed so well. The Republicans, by and large, are behind him, even though the kind of corruption and the kind of self-dealing or free spending, that should not be a partisan issue. But as on many things, the Republicans on the Hill are kind of lockstep backing both the Pruitt and the Trump administration in general. Mm.
And final question, Rebecca, when it comes to actual policies, one of your latest pieces, this might be Scott Pruitt's most destructive move yet. We touched on this earlier, but as you report, Pruitt announced sweeping new regulations that would restrict the kinds of scientific studies the agency can use in developing its regulations. You interviewed former EPA attorneys about this. Why do they say that this is one of the most destructive moves yet? Because environmentalists and attorneys say that there have been a lot so far.
Pruitt announced this move, as we were talking about earlier, as this move that made science more transparent. But it's what's really happening here, what really worries scientist organizations, former EPA employees, and probably current ones, is that it effectively limits what studies can be considered for when the EPA puts forward a rule. And the reason why is because Pruitt's new proposal requires the EPA to only use studies that publish all their data. And the problem when we're talking about public health studies and looking at how pollution affects the lungs and affects public health is that these studies rely on sensitive information like medical records, mm-hmm. and their privacy laws prevent that information from being disclosed in most cases. And even when redacted, you can actually figure out, given even limited information, how to tie those medical records to individuals. And so scientists say it's basically unworkable. You can't publish this kind of information, and in other cases they might be proprietary information that can't be published for other reasons, and you can't have that in government reports and still produce this quality of studies. So what that does is essentially take out of the equation the best available science we have on air pollution and health. And there is, it's important to note here that this policy affects academic institutions just as it affects industry studies, but the proposal Pruitt put forward has this carve-out, essentially, that gets around the industry concern that this would limit their own work, and it lets Pruitt decide what this new rule will apply to and what it won't apply to. And that, given Pruitt's history, you can guess what he might consider to be an acceptable exception to this rule and what isn't.
I don't know if we have more time, but I just wanted to quickly add that there are two studies in particular that this rule targets, and that is some a very big air pollution studies done by Harvard and by the American Cancer Society that were published in the early 90s. The industry has been trying to discredit those studies for years, and they really are the studies that it showed so clearly the effect of fossil fuel pollution on lungs and on mortality. And those studies have been corroborated over and over and over again since then. But the fossil fuel industry feels that if those studies are knocked out, that it will knock out the basis for a lot of clean air regulation.
Mm. Well, we have to definitely do a show about this. Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News. Marianne, thank you for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics. Be sure to read her piece, "This Might Be Scott Pruitt's Most Destructive Move Yet," at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for covering this.
Thank you. Well, now we are going to switch gears and talk about coverage of the Trump travel ban and the Iran deal. And joining us is Farnaz Fasihi, senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, covering foreign policy and the UN. She served for 14 years in the Middle East as a war and foreign correspondent, as a Baghdad bureau chief and deputy bureau chief for the Middle East and Africa. Hi, Farnaz. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Farnaz. Let's first start off by talking about the Iran deal. In the past couple weeks, Iran has become a major topic for the media because John Bolton took the top national security job at the White House. Mike Pompeo was just confirmed to become Secretary of State. And then we have Trump's continued attacks on the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. Given the very hawkish climate that we're seeing in Washington, What are your thoughts of the U.S. pulling out of this agreement? What are the chances of that? What does that mean for Iran?
I think that what we're seeing is that Mr. Trump has surrounded himself with advisors and cabinet members who think like him, especially when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to the Iran deal. They very much have the view that the Iran deal did not address the other concerns with Iran's regional influence and policies from Yemen, Syria, and the ballistic missiles. And you know, we've also seen for the past couple of months you know, increased effort by Europeans, capped by President Macron's visit to Washington this week, to try to salvage the deal, convince Mr. Trump to stay, and in exchange for staying, they would start a parallel conversation with Iran to come up with another agreement that would address the other concerns. But from what we can gather, reading between the lines and listening to the comments, it doesn't look like Mr. Trump was convinced, and it looks like by May 12th, he will not certify Iran. And when he does that, the sanctions against Iran's oil and banking transactions will automatically go back in place. And in effect, it means that the U.S. is pulled out.
You know, the other thing, Farnaz, that's getting attention is the sanctions. The deadline for Trump's decision is supposed to be on May 12th. He
Correct.
Needs to decide whether to reinstate the economic sanctions by then. You know, we hear the word sanctions, but what we don't often hear, unless we really look for it, is what have the impacts of the decades-long sanctions actually been on Iran and the people?
Iran's economy is in tatters. The effect is that the people's purchasing power has shrunk, that we have more people living beyond within the thresholds of poverty, unemployment, and just a sense of hopelessness that no matter what they do and what concessions that their government gives, you know, they can't seem to get to a point where they're really part of the international community. You know, Iranians, there's a big difference between the Iranian people and the Iranian regime, and the Iranian people are consistently victimized because of the regime's policies. You know, they face a lot of stress at home, but then also, you know, they face things like the travel ban, like difficulty getting visas to travel or immigrate, just difficulty doing businesses with countries abroad if sanctions go back. So, you know, they feel very defeated right now.
Mm. Where are you going for good reporting about what's actually happening on the ground there beyond the political reporting?
I have to tell you that there are not that many foreign reporters left in Iran. One of our key sources as we gather information has sort of become citizen journalists who share their stories. They take videos, they write commentary and share it on these Telegram channels. Telegram is a phone app that's very popular in Iran. There are several news groups that continuously throughout the day and the week upload sort of witnesses and first count reports from on the ground. And, you know, when you take that collectively in, you're able to get a read of what's happening inside.
Hmm. And going back to the Iran deal, Farnaz, I'm just thinking about media coverage of Iran. You also just hear Iran deal, Iran nuclear deal. I'm guessing
right.
that a lot of people really don't know what this deal is about. I mean, they might be able to talk about the overall, you know, a synopsis of it. But in terms of details, there was a piece in Foreign Policy by Richard Nephew, and he wrote, I helped negotiate the nuclear deal, and I know what would undo it. He writes
right.
that the agreement between the U.S., Iran, and other world powers is an enormously complicated document. Reading through and interpreting the interlocking series of steps, commitments, and expressions of intent takes considerable effort. So, Farnaz, what do you think is the most important aspects of this deal?
I think the most important aspect of this deal is that they got Iran to stop enriching uranium and close its nuclear facilities. Iran, of course, had always contended that they were for peaceful purposes, but nonetheless, they got them to export and get rid of the stockpile of uranium that they had, enriched uranium, and close their facilities. And this is at the United Nations and among diplomats. The Iran deal is hailed as one of the great successes of diplomacy in a world where diplomacy is failing on the Syria war, it's failing on Myanmar, it's failing on Yemen. The Iran deal was something that diplomats could be proud of because they managed to avert a disaster and another war and sanctions and suffering by negotiating and by concession. Now, the Iran deal decertification or Mr. Trump pulling out of the Iran deal is happening at the same time as the talks with North Korea. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of an impact it will have on negotiations with North Korea. One thinking is that if the North Korean regime looks to the Iran deal and says, well, the Iranians negotiated with the U.S. and with world powers for something like 10 years and came up with a very comprehensive deal, and with a change of administration, the U.S. abandoned it. So what guarantees will North Korea have that whatever deal that it reaches will be honored by other administrations in the U.S.?
Defense Secretary James Mattis testified on Capitol Hill on Thursday in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee and was asked about whether the U.S. should stay in the deal. And he said, quote, I've read it now three times. I will say that it is written almost with an assumption that Iran would try to cheat. Farnaz, when you look at the new people in this administration, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and then you look at what James Mattis says, there are a lot of hawks in the White House. What do you think is driving U.S.-Iran policy in this White House?
What's driving the Iran-U.S. policy is deep skepticism about Iran and Iran policies and the Iranian regime, and this view that you can't trust the Iranian regime no matter what, and even if they sign a deal, even if all the international organizations from the International Atomic Agency to the UN to European delegations say Iran is complying with its commitments, the U.S. administration still says, we don't think that Iran is complying. They seem to have made a judgment that is, absent of facts from international organizations. And I think that ideological view of this regime is evil and we don't want to have anything to do with it is very much driving the force here.
Do you think that what Mattis said is significant? Will this make any difference?
I'm not sure if it makes any difference in Trump's calculation and in Bolton's calculation because, you know, I think Mr. Trump, even from his campaign days, had been slamming the Iran deal, and it was very much one of his campaign slogans that he would get rid of this deal.
And I know we have to let you go in about 2 minutes, Farnaz.
Sure.
But just quickly, on Wednesday, the court heard oral arguments in Trump versus Hawaii. This is the case against the executive order banning entry for nationals of several countries, most of which are Muslim-majority states. So much of the coverage has been on what the judges said during the hearing. But NPR spoke to people who said things have really already drastically changed for Muslims wanting to come to the United States. What do you think of the coverage?
I think the coverage needs to sort of highlight the contributions that Americans from the targeted countries have made to American society and really take that in and look at these communities and look at the way that they've engaged and become American and uniquely contributed to this society and look at the impact that this has on families. If they can't have their loved ones come and visit. A lot of Iranians, North Koreans, Syrians cannot go back to their home countries. And if they can't have their relatives come here, this means that families are torn apart. And, you know, not everybody has the means or the ability to go meet in a third country and pay hotel fees and travel costs and bring everybody together in another country. That's one of the arguments as well. If you can't have your relatives come visit you here and you can't go back, go meet them in Europe. Well, that's just not a very logical argument. And, you know, it just goes against the ideals and what America stands for, which is really diversity and immigration.
Well, Farnaz, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to talk to you as always, Ruth.
Great to talk to you. Farnaz Fasihi is a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, where she covers foreign policy and the UN. She served for 14 years in the Middle East as a war and foreign correspondent and also as a Baghdad bureau chief. And you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. Your Call's weekly media roundtable is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to our past shows, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can see the list of shows there and then click to listen. You can also sign up for our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also leave us a review there. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. And please email your show ideas, guest ideas, and your feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Joshua Wilner is our social media producer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's weekly media roundtable.